He podcasts me, and I shall have him. I'll podcast him round the outer nebula, round Antares Maelstrom, and round Perdition Flames before I give him up. For your geek history lesson on Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is now in session. Hello and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I am Jason Inman.
I was wondering how long that was going to take. I'm Ashley Victoria Robinson. Welcome to your Mind University.
Blasted everybody's eardrums and I apologize.
Somebody on a subway somewhere is screaming in pain.
I could have gone much louder, but I didn't.
I know that for a fact.
What is this podcast, Ashley?
Well, you interrupted it.
I'm sorry.
Welcome to the podcast where we take one character, construct, or Star Trek movie from popular culture and teach you everything you need to know about it in about an hour. That's right, friends. It's a movie retrospective episode. And what are we doing and why, Jason?
We are talking about Star Trek II, colon, The Wrath of Khan.
Star Trek II, colon, Kirk is officially old.
Yes. Star Trek II, the colonoscopy begins. Go check that. Go get checked out.
Everybody. Yeah, no, but sure. Seriously.
This is, of course, it's the 40th anniversary.
Yes.
Yeah. Doing the math, right? It is the 40th anniversary of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. We love to celebrate movie anniversaries here. We just did Conan the Barbarian and all those various things. And Ashley and I are big Star Trek fans, so we thought we would dive deep into what a lot of people call the best Star Trek movie of all time.
So I was going to ask if you want to talk about that, or do we want to dangle this in front of people?
Oh.
Go request it on at GHL Podcast and on Instagram at Geek History Lesson.
You mean to do the best Star Trek movies of all time?
Yeah, or top five, you know, to do a list
Look,
episode.
I will say this. We have, I think, talked about doing that episode more than once.
I'm sure we have.
And I think the reason why we've decided not to do it up to this point is because we know automatically that number one is going to be one of two movies.
For me, there
maybe three. There's,
I was going to say, for me, there's three in the discussion.
Yeah.
And maybe if we did it, we would need a guest, someone to shake things up a little bit.
Well, I think, let's just say this. I think objectively, you and I have talked about this. Objectively, if you were just looking at the merits of the talents and the writing and the acting.
And their influence on further future Star Trek, yeah.
I kind of think you have to say it's Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. As the objectively best.
I think objectively, but our lists are not.
Yes. Yeah. It's not my favorite.
It's not my favorite either.
But I think objectively.
But it's definitely in my top.
Yeah.
It's definitely my top five.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into the 10-cent origin of this movie, Ashley.
Yes, that is the first part of the podcast where Professor Jason is going to tell you all of the basics, who's its and what's its galore about Wrath of Khan in case you go to a cool Star Trek movie themed cocktail party and somebody hasn't seen this yet. No shame, honestly.
The release date is June 4th, 1982. So Wrath of Khan is a Gemini like myself.
That's true.
It was directed by Nicholas Meyer with a screenplay by Jack B. Sowards, a story by Harv Bennett and Jack B. Sowards. Harv Bennett, everybody, if you are a fan of Star Trek, is somebody that you should research. He is responsible for this trilogy of movies.
He's a really important executive in the Star Trek world.
He is a big reason why Wrath of Khan happened the way it did. And without Harv Bennett, he recently passed away, actually. Without Harv Bennett, this Star Trek would have died in the 80s.
Yeah, it would have died after TMP.
Yeah, it would have died in the 80s. And so he's a guy that doesn't get a lot of shout outs. And I think a lot of people outside the Star Trek fandom don't know him, but you go Google him. He's a very fascinating writer.
Yeah, there you go.
This movie starred, of course, William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, woo! DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, Walter Koenig, George Takei, Nichelle Nichols, B.B. Besh, Merritt Buttrick, Paul Wilmfeld, Kirstie Alley, and Ricardo Montalban.
Iconic. Arguably his most iconic performance of all time.
I mean, it's a debate between this and Fantasy Island.
I mean, Fantasy Island definitely has more hours. That's what my mom knows him from, is Fantasy Island. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched Fantasy Island, but I'm going to say Khan was better.
I mean, you're probably right that this is probably his most iconic role. The music in this movie was by a brand new composer, James Horner. Of course, it's Paramount Pictures. The running time is 113 minutes. The
perfect length.
The budget for this movie, you want to make a guess? You also have to think about 1982 terms. It was a low budgeted movie.
I don't know my 1982 budgets. $10 million.
You're close. It was 12.
Oh, okay. 12 I thought that million. Was too low. Okay.
It made $97 million at the box office.
Holy Jesus yep. Christ. Wow. I mean, it's a great movie. Yeah. No wonder they were like, screw it. We'll just let these people make these movies till they literally die.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Wrath of the Khan was a runaway hit.
I mean, I knew it was a hit, but like, holy smokes.
Let's get to the meet cute, Ashley.
That is the second part of the podcast where we talk about the first time we did these characters and how cute it was. Jason.
Yes.
Where did you first see Star Trek 2 : The Wrath of Khan?
I don't know. I will honestly say that this is a movie kind of like The Empire Strikes Back that I just always kind of remember knowing and being familiar with. I would assume that it aired on television at some point in my childhood and we just watched it. I can tell you that I remember my first instance with Star Trek is, of course, The Next Generation.
Yeah.
That's the first thing of Star Trek I remember watching. And I know somewhere in that, I want to say, like, my mom or my dad was like, hey, you know, there are movies, too. And I was like, what? There's more?
If you don't remember your story, I'm going to ask you to tell one that you told me last night.
Sure.
Tell the story about when you showed your little brother Wrath of Khan for the first time.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, when I was in college, and I was going to college in old Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, like 3 years ago.
Yeah, sure.
Jason's a mere 21 years old.
One time, my little brother was like 8 or 9 or 10, somewhere in there, and he came and spent the weekend with me. And I remember that at the time he had been watching like TOS on television, like the remastered ones. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, did you? Kind of like what my parents did. Yeah. Did you know there are movies? And I think he was like, oh, there are movies? There's more? And I showed him Wrath of Khan. And I will tell you, I have a very conscious memory of him being like enraptured by this movie. Mm-hmm. Just him being like, whoa, which is surprising because this movie is about old people.
It is.
It's about people being like, oh, I'm old. You know, and James Kirk's like, oh, my hip. Oh. You know,
I would say that I think more like, oh, my eyes.
Oh, there you go. Fair. The rednecks.
I do think that most of the cast is working at the height of their brilliance here. It's a lot of very good performances from the original cast.
So where did you first see Wrath of Khan?
As with most of the Star Trek that I've seen in my life, Star Trek would air on Spike TV.
Did they air the Wrath of Khan network on Spike TV?
They would play the movies all the time on the weekends. So that was where I first watched Wrath of Khan.
Did you know, I've always known, kind of like Darth Vader.
Khan, yes.
Darth Vader is always, I've always known him as Luke's father. I've never had that reveal. Yep. I've always known that this is the movie where Spock dies.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Oh, so, no. you were very surprised.
Yeah, nobody in my family watched Star Trek.
Okay.
But I knew, like, Khan, because even before memes, it was, like, a memeable thing. Like The Simpsons parodied it, you know, a million cartoons parodied it. Yeah, I knew that moment. But no, I didn't know Spock died. Very upsetting.
Now, guys, when we get into the main lesson, we're going to be talking about, of course, all the spoilers. We always give away the biggest spoiler, of course, and the good nuggets of Wrath of Khan. But Ashley, I want to ask you, Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry actually had little to do with this movie, almost nothing. But he did write a script treatment for this movie where the Enterprise crew traveled back in time to meet a very famous American in the past. So I want you to think about who that person could be. And we're going to find out. After this. So, Ashley, after the release of the motion picture, executive producer and creator of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry, wrote his own sequel. He wrote his own Star Trek 2. And in his plot, the crew of the Enterprise travels back in time to set right a corrupted timeline after the Klingons use the Guardian Forever.
Oh, the Klingons.
Yes.
Okay, that changes my thought then.
What famous American did the crew of the Enterprise meet in the past?
Okay, so I'm assuming if they're meeting this American, they have to team up with them in some way, shape, or form.
Or save their life to defeat the Klingon. The Klingons killing them.
So the only historical American president that I think could even kind of go toe-to-toe with the Klingons is Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt. No. Because you have to think about where Gene Roddenberry's head is. Of course, he created Star Trek in the 60s. They met JFK.
Oh, that's not fun. That's not a historical figure.
No, it's weird. It's also like they.
I mean, I was going to do the Hamilton joke, but it felt too contemporary.
So in this version, the idea was the JFK, the Kennedy assassination, was somehow prevented.
Too soon to be. Look, yep. I know that's that is like the tropiest of all tropes for American time travel writers, but like too soon. Should have been the bull moose himself.
Well, let me give you a little. So here's the intro of this. Gene Roddenberry wrote this 60-page treatment in the spring of 1980.
Okay.
Now, in the story for this movie, the Enterprise returns to Earth to find bodies floating in space. They eventually discover that history has been changed by the Klingons. The Federation no longer exists. And as to why the Enterprise still exists, the answer is that anyone traveling at warp when the change of the timeline occurred is immune. And with the Federation never having existed, Earth is populated by a savage race of proto-humans. So they go to the Guardian Forever, and of course they go back in time and they repair the timeline.
This sounds like what if Stephen King wrote a Star Trek novel?
Stephen King?
Yeah, because, you know, like 11, 22, 63, whatever. Yeah, like, doesn't that also deal with the death of JFK? Like, it feels like if someone sat Stephen King down and said, okay, you have to write a Star Trek time travel script, that this is what he would have written.
Well, this was soundly rejected by Paramount executives, who blamed the tepid reception and the cost of the first film on its plotting pace and constant rewrites. As a consequence of this, Roddenberry was removed from the production and, according to Shatner, kicked upstairs to the ceremonial position of executive consultant. Now, here's the thing we need to say. The first Star Trek The Motion Picture was also a hit, but it was viewed as a failure.
Was it a critical failure?
I don't know.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm not going to Google it.
That's fine. But yes, I mean, it is kind of viewed, I think, in the canon as a failure. I think people are warmer on it now.
Yes.
But.
Well, I think because they expected it to be a Star Wars movie, and it wasn't a Star Wars movie. It didn't hit Star Wars box office level.
Was never going to be.
No.
That's not what Star Trek is.
No, Star Trek has never been that, and it never will be.
And it never should be. That's what we like about Star Trek.
Principal photography of The Wrath of Khan began on November 9th, 1981. It ended in January 29th, 1982. So they filmed this entire movie in 3 months. The Wrath of Khan was more action-oriented than its predecessor and actually cost less to make because the project was supervised by Paramount's television division and not their theatrical unit, which is another thing. Now, the film officially established that this is the 23rd century in Star Trek history for the very first time. According to Gene Roddenberry, the original series could have easily taken place between the 21st and the 31st centuries, and he wanted Stardates to allow for an ambiguity, but Nicholas Meyer, in the commentary, I have to remember listening to this, said that he put that up there because he thought that if his dad watched this movie, the first thing his dad would say is, like, when does this take place? So he put in the 23rd century. The original subtitle was Star Trek The Genesis Project. It was later changed to Star Trek II, then Star Trek The Undiscovered Country. Which
Ooh, it's a good title.
Which you can tell is a title that Nicholas Meyer had in his mind, which eventually becomes Star Trek VI. And subsequently, The Vengeance of Khan. This was discarded in deference to Star Wars Revenge of the Jedi, which was also in production. Now, the third subtitle was eventually used, you know, of course, like I said, The Undiscovered Country became Star Trek VI. So it's funny, we had Return of the Jedi was Revenge of the Sith, and this was The Vengeance of Khan. Both movies blinked and changed their titles.
That's so funny.
So it became Return of the Jedi, and then it became The Wrath of Khan. Which is so funny because you can tell that Lucas saved that title as well because he was like, I'm going to use this Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of studios do that recently too, though.
Yes. Producer Harve Bennett, as I mentioned earlier, viewed all the episodes of the 1966 Star Trek and chose Star Trek Space Seed as the best candidate for the sequel. Spock even remarks in the script that this would be interesting to return in 100 years or so to see what type of civilization had grown there, specifically talking about Space Seed. And actually, fun fact, this is the first time in feature film history that a feature film was made as a sequel to a television episode.
And what's interesting about this movie is you actually don't need to see Space Seed.
No. Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the opening and the death of fake Spock. We start in this movie at the opening of the Kobayashi Maru. This is the incident. It is three Klingon cruisers, which is footage from Star Trek The Motion Picture. They're saving money, people. And we see Savik, played by Christy Alley, and they all die. They all die. Spock dies. All this stuff like this. Ashley, what do you think about this opening?
It feels very long by a contemporary standard. Also because we're so used to Star Trek in television format where your like bumper scene is quite short. I like this scene. And I like a lot of stuff around the Kobayashi Maru. It's just a piece of mythology that I really enjoy in the Star Trek universe. And the reveal of Kirk is very, very cool. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a strong opening.
It is a very strong opening. Spock died in this opening scene specifically because rumors had gotten out that Spock was going to die in this movie.
Yeah.
So they intentionally fake kill him in the beginning so that fans would think that, oh, that's the Spock death that everybody saw.
Yeah.
Fun fact, actually, Leonard Nimoy refused to come back to this movie until they promised to kill him.
Yes, that's a very famous story.
And then he had so...
Then he said, just kidding.
Well, he had so much fun on the set of Wrath of Khan that he changed his mind.
Yeah.
You know?
Well...
He was like, oh, this isn't that bad. I like these ears.
The Star Trek team, the OG crew, were some of the first in modern history to deal with playing the defining role of your life as a very young person, mm-hmm. and what that meant. Like now we would all kill for roles like this where you would never have to work again and you could chase this, or not chase, but you could live off of this clout for the rest of your life. It was a very new thing. Mm-hmm. So I can understand why Nimoy and Shatner in particular like really struggled with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we went from I am not Spock to I am Spock.
Yes, he wrote both of those
in
books.
In terms of memoirs.
Ashley, let's talk about Savik. This is a brand new character, a female Vulcan in Starfleet. It's unclear whether she is supposed to be the second Vulcan in Starfleet, you know, because Spock is the first. But yeah, we do know that she is some type of Spock protege.
Yep.
I guess she definitely can't be because we saw Zahn, the Vulcan, in Star Trek, the motion picture.
There you go.
But forget the problematic actor.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Savik adding to this movie.
Why don't she got Vulcan eyebrows?
Yeah. Why don't she got Vulcan eyebrows? Do you like her performance? Because I said I actually prefer Robin Curtis, who plays Savik in Star Trek 3, over Kirstie Alley.
I think Savik is a much more interesting character than we've ever seen her executed by either actors.
I agree.
Unfortunately, that's...
If you want to learn more, go to Memory Beta and read all those Star Trek novels and find out what Savik does.
Yeah.
She probably goes back in time and saves the life of JFK. That's what I'm going to bet that.
Oh my God.
Savik's journey.
I do like the idea of, especially because it's an aging crew, of having a younger character, and I like making it a Vulcan, particularly with what happens to Spock and the Spock storyline. I don't mind Kirstie Alley's performance. I think she's okay. She does, all of her acting goes into her eyebrows and her forehead because she's trying to remain very stoic, which is a trap that a lot of Vulcan actors to the modern day fall into. But I like Savik also because she's kind of an echo of Spock from this series. And Spock is perpetually struggling with his own identity, but she embodies a lot of the same questions that we would have seen Spock ask back in TOS days. So I do enjoy having her on the crew. I don't necessarily know who at the time I would have cast instead, but she,
who knows?
Yeah.
I'm not asking you to like cast 1980 actors.
Leah Thompson. But
might have been a bit young.
I think so. Cadet Savik. But
cast her in everything.
Exactly. Or have her direct now.
She should have played Khan.
I mean, if she can make us believe she loves a duck, she's
directing Star Trek Picard right now.
That's true. So she's in the fam. Yeah. I believe that she would stab at me, but
she can stab me all she wants. No.
But I
that's
like,
Marty's mom. Let's not be gross, everybody.
No, but I like Savik. I think she's an interesting character.
She's an interesting addition to this crew.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also weird because, you know, like most of the TOS adventures, she gets a lot more play than like Scotty and Uhura and Chekhov and Sulu.
Yeah.
Like that's the downside about the TOS movies is that
they're Kirk and Spock movies.
They're Kirk, Spock, McCoy movies.
Yeah.
And it's just like the TNG movies, they become Data Picard movies.
Yeah.
And
DeForest Kelly's having the best time in this movie though. Like he just seems like he's thrilled to be there. He's funnier than he's ever been. Like, he's a good time in
this
movie.
He's always funny. He's like, remember that episode in TOS where he's asking for mint juleps?
Is that Shore Leave?
Yeah, no, it's This Side of Paradise.
There it is, yeah. It's one of those where they go down to the planets and everyone hallucinates.
They all get blasted by spores.
Yeah.
So this is a movie about a midlife crisis or old age.
Yeah.
Ashley, I know you already know the answer to this.
Yes.
But the script states that Kirk's age is 49 in this movie, which I did not know.
Yeah.
And Shatner was 51
yeah.
when he filmed this movie.
The vanity of him being like, I will not say I'm 50.
Well, it's funny because Shatner was very reticent about giving out Kirk's age. Now, they don't say it anywhere in the movie.
No.
Which I think is the smart choice. But it's fun fact, Kirk's birth date is actually established in canon. It is March 22nd. And it's actually on, it's actually, that's also William Shatner's birthday. But Star Trek Enterprise episode In a Mirror Darkly Part 2 on a Federation computer record establishes it to be March 22nd. So as we were talking before, Ashley, that makes him a what in the astrological sense?
Makes him an Aries.
Yes. And so I want to talk to you, like, is Captain Kirk a typical Aries?
Both Captain Kirk and William Shatner are incredibly Aries.
Really?
Energy. Yeah, Shatner a little bit more so. I would guess Kirk, I could literally do his birth chart because we do know where he's born and his birthday.
Riverside, Iowa.
Maybe that'll be like some
let's not go
paywall
that
episode someday.
For a fictional character.
Yeah. But he gives me like water or earth sign rising or moon because he's a little, Kirk is more down to earth than William Shatner, ironically enough. But that cowboy aspect, that's very Aries for sure. Mm-hmm. It's very like Aries Leo energy. But I only know that because recently I pulled like a bunch of other like Aries geeky characters.
Oh, who are some of the other Aries geeky characters? I'm just curious.
Goku from
Dragon Ball?
Dragon Ball Z.
Okay.
All the Dragon Balls, but I know him from Dragon Ball Z. And T'Challa.
Oh, really?
The Black Panther.
Is he? He doesn't seem, he's a very calm, chill dude.
He is. I would actually probably, if I were picking his astrological sign, but maybe he's, if he's at the end of the Aries cycle, then if he's on the cusp with Taurus, that would make a little bit more sense. But he gives me like big earth sign vibes, like very like grounded, chill, in control. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I guess because he's a warrior.
Yeah.
Look, we all
have
know
you
that,
looked up Spock?
I have not. I can look it up right now. But also, what? Do they have the same months on Vulcan?
Oh, that's fair. But he is half human, so you would think
Spock's birthday? It's the autofill.
That they would have given him a Earth birthday.
Oh, right? There's apparently in the U.S., there is a holiday called National Socks Day, which is what is my first search result. January 6, 2230. I think that makes him an Aquarius or a Cap. Yeah, I am Googling very poorly.
This is compelling podcast.
You're welcome. He's a Capricorn.
Kind of.
Capricorn's hard-headed.
Well, also, again, like, he was not born on Earth.
Yeah.
So, and also, he's half a species that doesn't exist.
I guess you can also argue, though, that the stars are the stars are the stars, but also, is Vulcan in our star system?
No.
So.
Well, technically, here we go. We should be able to see Vulcan from our sky, technically.
Is Vulcan not in the Beta Quadrant?
I don't know exactly. It kind of is, but in almost every Star Trek series, you can travel from Earth to Vulcan
in
4 days.
Yeah, 4 days. Yeah.
So, and that's in Enterprise time, in NX-01 time. So when your maximum warp is 5 times the speed of light.
Sure. Okay.
So if you can get there in 4 days.
So it's probably right on the border of Alpha Beta Quadrant.
Well, yeah. Well, let's not even get the Star Charts. It's crazy. As I once heard a great Star Trek writer, Iris Stephen Bear, once say about the, you know, there's that Star Trek stellar cartography map.
Yes. Yeah.
I heard him once say in an interview, he said, he was like, that is just somebody trying to make sense of writers throwing darts.
Yes, but I mean, isn't that what fandom is?
I know. So you can't really like...
I know. Amazon's about to do that same thing for the Lord of the Rings entire continuity.
Yeah. It's just writers being like, Perseus 5! You know?
Yeah. Well, it is funny. I've seen versions of that map as well, where you see how clustered some areas become.
Or you see like the trail of the Enterprise and it just crisscrosses over itself. And you're like, no military vessel would travel in that path.
Yeah.
But again, it's some publishing person was just trying to be like, oh, how do I make this? Okay, Vulcan's here. Cardassia is over here.
Well, the wormhole has a bunch of stuff around it too. But look, I from a marketing and from a sales perspective, I also understand why you make that.
Of course, I would buy it.
Absolutely.
I own it.
I know you do.
Let's talk about my favorite scene in the movie, actually, is the scene right after this training montage where Kirk and Spock are, Spock gives Kirk his gift, A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Message Spock. I love how the way he goes, message Spock.
Spock in his best costume of all time.
And then you like the red naval uniforms of Wrath of Khan.
I do. I'm
not a fan of them.
I like them. If I were in charge of Star Trek, I would keep those as like a dress uniform. I like them because they feel naval in a way that a lot of their other uniforms don't.
See, that's the reason why I hate them, because I am of Gene Roddenberry famously hated these uniforms. I'm with Gene Roddenberry because I like the idea that Starfleet is not a military organization.
Peacekeeping Armada
I like peacekeeping Armada.
Resonate with, well, like Armada is a military term.
I understand, but I agree that the uniform should not look military.
Well, I like them.
But yeah, no, this is, for a lot of people, this is like their favorite uniform.
I would, I don't know. I just think there's something about them that's very striking. Maybe it is the red.
They're much, much better than the motion picture.
Oh, my God, yes.
Those weird pajamas.
Yeah. Where you can see everybody's features.
Yep.
Starkly defined.
Yep. Everybody's stem bolts are just out there. See.
Really startling, actually.
What do you think about the A Tale of Two Cities? Because at the time, I like it because at the time, that was not trope or cliche. This is the movie that introduces that into, I think, now we see a million. I mean, even Dark Knight Rises did it.
Oh, and no, I hate it because I have no time for Charles Dickens. No. I hate Charles Dickens.
No time for, that's a Broadway musical
awful
title over there.
No time for Charles Dickens. No Chaucer, no Dickens, useless to
no
me.
No Chaucer, no Dickens.
I appreciate that Spock would give him a piece of literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's an intelligent choice, but.
And McCoy gives him glasses.
He does.
Because Kirk is allergic to Rednox 5 to cure his eyes. He can't do the laser eye surgery.
That's a great detail, though, that actually like drives the plot forward. Because Kirk should definitely be having readers at his age. Mm-hmm. It's coming for all of us. Mm-hmm. It's not a drag.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have readers in the 23rd century, Ashley.
You do if you're allergic to...
Rednox 5?
Retinol.
Rednox 5.
Retinol.
Yeah. For most patients your age, Jim, I treat Rednox 5. I'm allergic to Rednox 5. Hence the glasses, Jim.
Yeah. They do make him look, and the way that they perch him on the end of his nose, like Mrs. Claus, like he does look very old when he puts the glasses on.
All right, let's talk about the Reliant. We cut to the Reliant. We see Pavel Chekhov, Captain Terrell, beam down to Sitti Alpha 6, and they run into the genetically engineered tyrant, Khan Noonien Singh, who reveals,
this is
Sitti Alpha 5!
And his Muscle Beach crew of augments.
Yes. Let's talk about Khan here, Ashley.
Yes, let's.
It's funny because even though Kirk and Khan are enemies, they never meet once in this movie besides through view screens. So this is very much a submarine movie. It's an internal battle. What do you think about Khan? What do you think about the choice of bringing Khan as this villain? You know, there's problems to this. There's also like, well, there's problems for the legacy of the franchise going forward from this choice.
Yeah, there's also like, let's just address like the elephant in the room that is Khan Noonien Singh. Khan Noonien Singh is specifically mentioned to be a Sikh character, meaning of Middle Eastern descent, played by
Benedict Cumberbatch.
A Latinx actor. Yeah, who later goes on to be played by the whitest white man in Hollywood. That's not great. Mm-hmm. I will give Wrath of Khan a little bit, and the original Star Trek a little bit more of a pass, just given the sort of ethics and morals of the time. But like, that's not great. Mm-hmm.
Originally in Star Trek and Darkness, it was supposed to be Benicio del Toro.
Do you know that when they cast Cumberbatch, he was supposed to be Gary Mitchell?
I do know that.
Yeah, he told me that. Yeah, and I will die upset about that. Mm-hmm. I will literally pass away being upset.
No, originally the storyline was Gary Mitchell.
Benicio would have been great,
originally,
actually.
Originally the story was Gary Mitchell. Then they switched to Khan. Then they were like, let's get Benicio del Toro. Then Benicio del Toro said no. Then they got Benedict.
I mean, like, there's not a million South Asian actors who could play freaking
Khan. But let's talk about Wrath of Khan.
Yes.
And the choice to bring back a villain from the original series.
I wouldn't have picked Khan.
Who would you have picked? From your knowledge of the original series episodes, if you could have made a sequel to one of those episodes, what would you have done?
This character has a name. Who is the Romulan lieutenant?
You have to get way more specific.
From... Is it Balance of Terror?
There's multiple of Romulan episodes.
the first one where he's got like his forehead's covered. Oh man, him and Kirk talk through the view screen.
So I don't know who are you talking about. You're talking about. I don't think
this character has a name. I just think he's called the Romulan.
Are you talking about the one that's played by Mark Leonard?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think he has a name.
That's the character.
He also dies.
Oh, does he die?
Yeah, he blows up.
Oh, damn it.
he blows up.
You
could make it his brother.
Yeah, maybe. I hate siblings in Star Trek, though.
I'm surprised you didn't say Trelane. Everybody's favorite Q from the original series.
I hate Qs. I only love Trelane when he's played by Hal Rudnick.
You know. You know, it's interesting because, like, some of TOS's greatest villains are just these random monsters.
Yeah, or clouds, vapor
like
clouds.
Like the Gorn, like Kang and Koloth, the Klingons, you know, but they
almost said Kodos, didn't you?
I did. but, you know, like, I can understand how they're like, let's not do a Klingon movie. And also, let's not.
I mean, maybe Khan was the best choice, but he wouldn't have been my first choice.
He wouldn't have been my first choice either. At all. Like, I can't pull another one.
Maybe if Ricardo Montalban had maybe made some overtures over the years being like, hey, if you ever want to have me back, I would love to do it.
I don't know.
I don't know. But just from my knowledge.
Well, it's Harve Bennett was the one that made the choice to do Khan.
No, I know. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, like that could have been made like when the television show was on. You know what I mean? He would be like, I'll come back anytime. You know what I mean? I just think Khan is like a kind of a weird choice.
He is. Let's get some. So interestingly enough, Khan talks about this whole revenge happens because of his deceased wife. That deceased wife is Lieutenant Maria McGivers, who was when Khan was revived by the Enterprise crew. In Spacey, Lieutenant McGivers is manipulated by Khan to help him hijack the Enterprise, and then she goes to Khan with his followers to Seti Alpha 5.
I think we should have seen her.
I agree, but I think that would have just complicated all kinds of factors, and you know, who knows if the original actress was still acting at the point or anything like
that. She was really good in Spacey, though, because that's a character who only exists in that episode, mm-hmm. and the turn to loving Khan is so quick and so unearned, and she just goes for it 1,000,000%.
Yeah. Let's also talk about the biggest continuity error in possibly all of Star Trek. So, when Khan meets Captain Terrell, and I think Chekhov's a commander at this point, Khan recognizes Chekhov. Now, Pavel Chekhov did not appear in Star Trek until Amok Time, the first season of the first episode of season two of Star Trek.
Yep.
Space Seed is in the first season.
Yep.
So Chekhov is not part of the Enterprise crew. Now, there are arguments, and I've always said this in my headcanon, that I was like, well, Chekhov was on the Enterprise, but he wasn't in the senior crew. So he wasn't on the bridge.
I also think that
he was wandering around the corridors.
I think it would be a mistake to not have Chekhov recognize Khan.
Yeah.
Like, that is the whole point of having Chekhov be in the scene.
Yes.
In a lot of ways. And Captain Terrell is a much more interesting character to watch in this scene. I don't mind this continuity error. I agree. He's on the Enterprise. This was a famous event. Of course he would know who Khan is.
Walter Koenig once famously joked at a convention that Chekhov made Khan wait in line at the space toilet once, which explains Khan's vivid memory of him.
Ha ha, I guess.
According to the novelization of Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, Chekhov was actually working in security during Space Seed and managed to delay Khan when he was taking over engineering in the original series. And this impressed Captain Kirk enough to offer Chekhov a position on the bridge.
That's a nice bit of retconning. Yeah. I don't mind that.
Yeah. So we all head to the research station, Regular One, by having Chekhov inform Dr. Carol Marcus, the head of the Genesis Project, that Kirk has ordered them to take possession of the Genesis
with
device.
The hardest hair in this
so
movie.
So Khan he's got in charge of the Reliant. He's got this stuff like that. Ashley, let's talk about Carol Marcus and, excuse me, Dr. Carol Marcus.
There you
and
go.
Dr. David Marcus, the lady and the son of Kirk.
The Enterprise has something to say about her being called the lady.
Well, that's fair. The Enterprise is going to throw down a couple photon torpedoes right on Carol. I have a very question on Front Street for you, Ashley.
Okay.
If you dated Captain Kirk.
Yes.
And he gifted you with a love child, would you keep it a secret for him for 20 years?
First of all, this is the 23rd century. You're telling me that, like, birth control is not incredibly easy. And, you know, like Planned Parenthood is not utterly obsolete. And I'm not.
In Deep Space Nine, it's injections. They say it. They actually confirm.
There you
that.
Go.
They say it's injections.
I'm not advocating that like David should have been aborted or anything like that.
Oh boy.
But
no, we're not saying that.
No, I would definitely not. I mean, look, here's my advice. Unless the man is an absolute monster who would kill that child with his bare hands, show some respect.
Kirk might. He goes on a lot of strange missions.
He would not.
He goes evil. Kirk has turned evil like multiple
times.
That's
true. No, Kirk would be the person who would let his child play too close to like the edge of a mountain, and then the kid would fall to his death.
Well, that's how you make love.
To the mountain?
To the mountain. You have to.
I mean, maybe they would have the rocket boots on and he'd be fine.
The mountain. Be one with the mountain. That's a reference. Go Google it.
The amount of cocaine that must have been in that interview. No, I wouldn't have done that. I struggle because Carol Marcus is a character that I actually really like, and I really respect, and I don't think that's an ethical thing to do. And they seem warm toward each other. They seem friendly. And
Kirk knows that David exists.
I know. And that's, to me, like there's.
And then somehow, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but the scene at the end, David obviously, like.
It's David's best scene.
Somewhere in his lifetime, his mom told him.
Yes.
But we're given the impression, and I like this is like great storytelling. This is why like this is great scripting by Harve Bennett and I forget the other writer, that they make us think that David has no clue.
Yeah.
For the majority of the movie.
I do get a little lost in the ethics of like one, Kirk not being told, and then two, Kirk choosing not to have a relationship, because I don't think Kirk would do that. I really don't. Even if he knew when David was like 20.
Well, he said he respected her wishes, so there is something.
Yeah, but that's his child.
I understand.
I don't agree with it. I don't like it. It's one of my least favorite details about both of those characters.
It is a thing that it only works in the world of storytelling because it makes it a bit more like Arthurian almost.
I don't like it.
I understand. I want to talk about Carol Marcus here.
Yeah.
So we are presented with this woman that we have never met before in Star Trek history.
Yeah.
And the idea that this is the woman that captured Captain Kirk's heart.
Yeah.
Like, it is Dr. Carol Marcus, a character we've never met before. What do you think of Carol Marcus? What do you think of the actress? What's her name? Bebe Bech. What do you think about Carol in this movie? I really like Carol Marcus.
Bebe Bech does a lot with very little on this character. I like her a lot. Again, the hardest hair in the whole movie. The 80s were not kind to beautiful women. Mm-hmm. They make her look a million years old with that old lady haircut. I think Carol Marcus is so interesting because there is a direct line from Carol Marcus to Dr. Beverly Crusher.
Really?
She is proto Crusher.
Okay.
100%. Like a professional woman with a child who don't need no man, who's at the top of her game, who's an incredible mother. Like Beverly is, you know, a directly derivative of Carol Marcus. And I like the idea because we've seen Kirk have many conquests and many romantic entanglements. I like the idea that the woman who captured his heart doesn't need him and doesn't want him.
And also has a strong career on her own.
Yeah, she's not a damsel. Yep. Like she's running this incredible station. She's the head of this incredible project that's going to save his best friend's life. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert for the forthcoming movie.
Well, it makes it.
I like it that he's in love with this capable woman.
Exactly. He basically fell in love with the female version of himself. That she is like,
or an analog.
As dedicated as he is to the Enterprise, she is dedicated to science.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a fun little Star Trek fact that I have put into my headcanon about this.
Okay.
So Star Trek fans have speculated that Dr. Carol Marcus is the little blonde technician, exact words from the script, with whom Gary Mitchell admitted to collaborating to distract Kirk within a romance in the second pilot episode where no man has
I know
gone
exactly
before.
Who you're talking. Yep. They kind of have the same hair.
Yep.
And I think she's wearing blue.
No. I don't think they ever see her.
Oh, I thought we saw her from the back.
But Gary mentions a little blonde technician that distracted Kirk with a romance. And to be honest with you, since Gary Mitchell was Kirk's best friend.
Headcanon accepted.
Headcanon accepted.
I love that. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, and this is going a little bit off the weeds because it's a completely different character. I actually kind of liked in Star Trek Into Darkness that they brought Carol Marcus back. that they like tried to revamp Carol Marcus.
I mean, I like that they tried.
Yes.
But I think try would be the operative word there.
I agree.
She is somehow way more exploited than she is in the 80s.
That's so. Fair. All right. So, of course, Kirk and Spock and McCoy get a brief video on Project Genesis, where we see Project Genesis basically form. Like, this is what it is. Of course, this is...
drum roll, please.
This is the first use of computer, a fully CGI sequence in a motion picture. When you see the Genesis planet get reformed and stuff like that.
I didn't know this until Jason told me yesterday. And I have to say, even by today's standards, it looks pretty good. It's so I can't imagine how it must have blown people's minds or how long it took to render at the time.
So the special effects for this film were done by Industrial Light and Magic. And this was specifically done by Industrial Light and Magic's animation department. So it's the demonstration of the effects on the Genesis device on the barren planet. This sequence, Ashley, convinced Steve Jobs, when he saw this in theaters, to buy the department that made this clip.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And this department would later go on to become Pixar.
Can you also tell the story about George Lucas seeing this scene?
Oh, George. So apparently, because
George Lucas owns ILM.
George Lucas was working on Return of the Jedi, and, you know, they were making the effects for Return of the Jedi. They're making effects for Wrath of Khan. George Lucas, apparently, they showed this clip to George Lucas, and he said, that's an amazing camera move.
Yeah. Yeah, which, you know, from George is high praise.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about, do we want to talk a little bit about Spock's death? Or was that jumping way too far? That's jumping a little bit too far.
Okay.
My notes have Spock's death like right here, which I do not know why. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit. We're going to talk about this a little bit now. So Spock's death in the film was widely reported. It was leaked. It was thrown out. Trekkies wrote letters in protest. They paid for full page advertisements in the trades. And Leonard Nimoy received death threats for killing Spock.
This is the 80s equivalent of release the Snyder Cut.
Yes, it is. It is. But I just want to throw out that was out there, that people were like, you can't kill Spock. What?
Look, I would have been devastated. Mm-hmm. I would have been absolutely like Spock is like hands down my favorite Star Trek character, which I know doesn't make me unique. But like I can understand why you would be upset, but also like. It's just a movie.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be in your head canon.
You know, so we get to the point where we have the first confrontation between the Reliant and the Enterprise. Ashley, do you like the design of the Reliant, the upside down Enterprise?
I do too.
You want to know a fun fact? The Reliant is used for the next 30 years in Star Trek.
Yeah.
It just seems like yeah. it is used in TNG and DS9 for years. In fact, most famously, the model for the Reliant is adjusted to be the Stargazer in the Next Generation Picard ship. It is also not even changed at all, besides the name on the hull, to the Saratoga, which is the ship that Ben Sisko's wife dies on.
Yes, Jennifer. Yes. There's a lot of reused assets in this movie. The space station is flipped upside down.
It's the space station from the motion picture.
The Klingon warship. Is the Nebula
reused? The Klingon warship's in Star Trek 3.
Oh, sorry. Is the Nebula's also reused?
The Mutara Nebula. What they do is they scrape the Reliant and the Enterprise out of it.
Yeah, that's right.
And it is, if you go watch the Next Generation episode, The Best of Both Worlds.
Iconic two-parter.
It is the Nebula that the Enterprise hides from the Borg cube in. It's the same Nebula. And I think TNG uses it a couple other times too.
So what I'm saying is reduce, reuse, recycle extends beyond the cans in your kitchen and can also go to visual effects as well.
That's right. So we finally get Kirk and Khan talking for the first time ever. The Reliant blasts the Enterprise right at main engineering and it cripples the Enterprise because that's where all your power comes from in a starship. Everybody, don't you know that? Jesus, did you go to warp field mechanics class? Yes, you didn't. And, you know, Kirk and Khan have their first view screen to view screen confrontation where neither actor ever talked to the other actor.
Can you believe they didn't have like an actual fist fight with like the double fist punches?
Yeah, they never had it. They did. There's no fist fight.
Like
in
two
movie.
Characters absolutely begging to come to blows.
But here's the thing. And I blame Marvel on this. Ever since the MCU has become big. Huge since the Avengers, the first Avengers movie. I'm going to put it
2012.
Right there. Every franchise now leads to the climax is some sort of fist fight.
It's Jason's favorite part about Star Trek Into Darkness.
It makes no sense to me. And that's the thing about this is that, especially in Star Trek, I don't believe a fist fight is your climax because this is this franchise that is about nonviolence.
Star Trek, to borrow a phrase from Mission Log, centers around morals, meanings, messages, right? Mm-hmm. Ethics are at the front of this. Strange New Worlds is in every single episode so far, Captain Pike has been like, we solve our problems by debate. That's like the message they are driving home. So particularly because we in the one of the opening sequences, like you talked about, we see Kirk walking around with like a classic piece of literature, The Tale of Two Cities, Best of Times, Worst of Times, which also to me exemplifies something that you and I talk a lot about. Like Captain Kirk is a by the book captain. This movie, that is the thesis of this movie. As he tells Savick several times.
This is actually the movie, in my opinion, that introduces the I take risk and chances, because what is his solution for the Kobayashi Maru? He cheated.
But being by the book also means that you know when to bend the rules, sure, which Kirk does. And so it makes complete sense to me that they would come to a resolution largely via discourse. Mm-hmm. I just feel bad for the actors because you're reading with either nothing or a nice script supervisor who's not giving you anything because they're not an actor. Like the performances.
I don't know whether it was Nicholas Meyer that read against both of them. I can't remember.
But either way, yeah, like you're not getting anything. And it's two great performances by both actors. And Ricardo Montalban is going full ham, eating the scenery. And I love it.
Well, as I always tell, I will tell Ashley and I will tell our listeners, the Reliant Bridge is the Enterprise Bridge redressed.
Yeah, which is why they couldn't really be together.
They didn't have the money. They shot the Enterprise Bridge first.
Yeah,
and then shot the Reliant second. I heard that Ricardo Montalban visited the set during some of these scenes, but he never read against William Shatner.
Yeah.
And William Shatner never read against Ricardo Montalban.
And the hardest thing, I think, for Ricardo...
No, part of that also, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're fine.
Part of that was Ricardo Montalban's schedule due to Fantasy Island.
But also William Shatner has a whole crew of actors that he's worked with for decades at this point supporting him in that scene, and Ricardo Montalban has that one guy who didn't get credited and a bunch of other extras who don't speak.
Yes.
So
well, I also love too, because again, this is the great scene where Kirk pulls out his glasses and
he won't let Khan see him in his glasses.
At every point he goes, damn. At every point Kirk beats Khan by knowing the Enterprise better than he does.
I think Kirk's intellect often gets overshadowed by Spock being there, but Kirk is no dummy.
The prefix code, the idea that like you can tap in a code and you can take control of another Federation starship, is genius.
But it also makes sense, right? Yeah. Because if an admiral comes in and you're really messing things up, like they would seize control of your vessel, just like in a naval tradition, you would board and you would overtake the vessel.
Well, that's why and Leonard Nimoy blows this line out of the water. There's a great line in that scene where Spock goes, unless he hasn't changed it, you know, he is quite clever, you know.
Yeah. Leonard Nimoy is so freaking good in this movie. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
So we beam down, we get away from the battle because Kirk tricks him, and now we're in a chase around the regular one. They beam down to the station. We see all the people are dead. Spock and McCoy and Kirk build a rope pulley system and then lower and raise some bodies for no reason.
They have transporters.
They have like mag level. They have like floaty platforms. And they're like, hold on, Spock. Hold on, McCoy. Let me put a pulley up there and pull this rope.
Yeah, this is where the movie tries to do some horror vibes for like 7 minutes. It's kind of strange.
So for a majority of this, Kirk asks for a damage report. Spock reports, by the book, hours would seem like days and main power will not be available for 2 days, which, of course, Khan overhears. Kirk finds the Genesis device. He finds Dr. Carol Marcus. He finds this like giant cavern full of amazing matte painting, which looks beautiful.
So beautiful.
He's like, wow, that matte painting looks great. I didn't know Genesis could make matte paintings. And they're like, yeah, we're going to make a lot of money in Hollywood. And Kirk's like, fantastic. And then Khan beams the Genesis device away, which leads to the most famous,
funny.
It echoes into
space,
the vacuum of space where sound cannot exist.
Yeah, in space, no one can hear you scream.
Yes. What do you think about, there's a beautiful scene between Carol and Kirk when they talk about this. Yeah. And like David tries to stab Captain Kirk or Admiral Kirk. He doesn't know that it's him.
Yeah, David's a walking bunch of daddy issues.
He very much is. He's probably like 26.
I mean, at least.
Yeah. He's in his late 20s.
And it's wild because Merrick Buttrick just like looks like a Ken doll. Yeah. Like he looks like a doll I had growing up.
Yeah, and he's in a jumper.
He's so handsome.
Yeah, it's like they like refashioned one of the motion picture jumpers and they're like, get in that.
I always wondered if they intentionally cast him because he's a very soft man. Mm-hmm. So the character of David comes across much more like Carol than like Kirk.
Mm. I think they cast him because he's blonde.
I mean, he is blonde and handsome, but
so
like,
he looks like Carol, and also he looks like classic.
He does look like Shatner.
Shatner,
but he could have been so easy to have a real like Han Solo, Captain Kirk type of Chris Pratty kind of attitude guy, instead they've gone the opposite. He's very introspective.
That's fair.
Until he tries to stab his dad.
What do you think about? So we're gonna talk about. Eventually, we get to the point where you know Kirk is like, "I feel old," and Carol's like, "I'm gonna show you this cavern, wee," and then he eats the space apple, and Savick says, "Please, for God's sake, for Vulcan's sake, tell me how you beat the Kobayashi Maru. I've been bothering you about this the entire movie. You gotta tell me."
I kind of find it charming that she can't let it go.
This is one of the, because it betrays logic to her,
yeah,
that somebody could beat it,
yeah, but it's petty. It's yes. A very human reaction.
Mm-hmm. And there's a nice touch that in Star Trek 2009 that J.J. Abrams does where he, when we see the scene where Kirk beats the Kobayashi Maru, mm-hmm. he's eating an apple, yeah, just like this scene.
Yeah.
Now, I am a big believer that the Kobayashi Maru is overused in Star Trek now. Very much overused.
I think so. I do enjoy it, though. Jason also hates the idea that Spock created it.
I do. I don't believe that a test made of emotions and about emotions and character would have been built by Spock.
But like Devil's Advocate, Spock is pretty emotional.
And it's the one retcon that doesn't. I understand why you do it for the movie. But
I don't have any real feelings about it. But I think it's interesting that it bothers you.
It does not exist in my headcanon.
That's fine. That's the great thing about headcanon.
Yes. So we get to this point and then we find out that, of course, which I don't buy because they say the idea that Kirk has never lost.
That's just not true.
Well, if you've watched TOS
at all, it's like not true.
So many crewmen have died in TOS.
Yeah. Like Kirk has had personal loss.
Edith Keeler, his true love, died in the city on the edge of forever.
Like Kirk has failed at numerous things. Like I understand the line, but mm-hmm. it's just badly false.
Well, I think we're trying to like really
we're splitting hairs.
We are. So he beams back up to the Enterprise. We get a chase through the Matara Nebula.
Beautiful.
Where it's like these ships are just going in circles back and forth, up and down, until eventually Spock suggests that Khan's thinking is two-dimensional, which is very interesting because every fight and battle, even almost to this day in Star Trek, is almost two-dimensional.
Well, I think it's because most people haven't been to space and they don't understand. The Expanse does a really good job actually at playing with this, that in space you can also go up and down.
Yes.
In addition to side or front to back. Mm-hmm. I liked this detail as well because of the sheer number of times we've seen Spock playing 3D chess. Mm-hmm. So I like that line.
Yeah. So we basically get to the point where Kirk blasts the Reliant pretty good. Khan activates the Genesis device, and they get the information there. And of course, Spock is like, we got to go to warp to beat this thing, or else we're gonna die.
Yep.
And Scotty's like, the main line, or the line, I can't remember what it is. It's like the main line is like broken. The mains. They keep calling it the mains.
Very naval.
I don't know. The warp drive is very inoperable. And this leads to Spock running to the engine room. He nerve pinches Dr. McCoy and says, "Remember," and then he goes inside. Now, Captain Spock, yes, he's a captain in this movie, his mind meld with Dr. McCoy was not in the original script. Nicholas Meyer also did not direct this scene. This was added after test audiences said they wished there was hope that Spock could be revived. When Paramount Studios ordered this change, Meyer threatened to take his name off the film. However, according to Leonard Nimoy's autobiography, I Am Spock, Harve Bennett approached him during the original filming of the scene and suggested doing a mind meld with Bones as a thread that we could pick up in a later film. And it was Nimoy who suggested the single word, "Remember." Now, also, the end credit scene that we see where we see Spock's pod is on the Genesis planet was also a reshoot because of the test audiences. They filmed it in LA. No, they filmed it in San Francisco in Golden Gate Park.
Oh, that's
Park.
Right. Yeah. With some extra ferns.
Yeah, Nicholas Meyer did not film it. He didn't even edit that cut. He actually said that he was like, I was fine with it. Whatever.
Look, I'm going to say Nicholas Meyer was wrong. That's a great moment between Spock and Bones.
Yes. So let's talk about Spock's death. I love, one of my favorite shots in the entire movie is the empty chair.
Yeah.
When Kirk looks over and Spock's chair is empty. I saw a lot of people share that image when Leonard Nimoy passed away.
Very sad.
Let's talk about Spock's death. Ashley, your favorite Star Trek character of all time is Spock. So
yep.
Let's talk about this scene.
It's a great death. It is one of the best pop culture deaths. It's one of the best like death in stories. Like forget about Star Trek. Like it's an excellent death.
It might be one of the best. I would argue it might be one of the best movies deaths in motion picture history.
Yeah, so much so that Hallmark made it into a Christmas ornament.
Yeah, that's what I want to celebrate. The irradiated corpse of my best friend.
Yeah, exactly. The green makeup is really well done, and the peeling prosthetics is really well done. I love the detail also in Spock's makeup that they always paint him a little more yellow because he has green blood, not red blood. I've always loved that. But it's understated. Leonard Nimoy plays it really straight. He's not overly emotional, which you could have done the take where a Vulcan gets panicked and emotional in death.
Sure.
But I really like how restrained it is. And I think that echoes in Shatner's delivery of the eulogy later. It makes me teary-eyed every single time I watch it. But of all the characters that I believe would sacrifice themselves, it's Spock. Like absolutely him following the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. It's poetry. It's art.
I have been and always shall be your friend, is like an amazing line.
The one detail that I don't like about it is when Spock puts up the live long and prosper and Kirk just puts up his hand. I think he should be echoing the live long and prosper.
Oh, see, no, to me, that is the perfect of Vulcan and human.
Yeah, to me, I guess I'm like, if someone's dying, you give them what they need. So like if someone is dying and they say, pray for me, if you're not religious, you absolutely pray with them.
William Shatner famously originally wanted this to entirely be in silhouette and to not be able to see anything of Leonard Nimoy.
No, wrong.
Exactly.
Wrong, that, so wrong.
But I will say,
if this was on stage, that would have been a cool take,
In my research, I also found that that chamber apparently was almost airtight and they had to put like several air hoses in there to pump air into Leonard because Leonard kept getting lightheaded.
That's awful.
Yeah.
That is deep. Yeah. Like, why was it sealed?
I don't know.
Who do you, production, who built that?
I mean, to me, I'd be like, just build a door off camera.
Yeah, just make it three walls.
Yeah. But apparently it was almost completely air.
That's awful.
Here's an original thing. This is actually in the movie script. In the movie script, Dr. McCoy says before this whole speech happens, he goes, "He's dead, Jim."
Yeah.
And DeForest Kelly feared the line would draw unintentional laughs.
Does he say he's dead already?
No. Scotty says, "Sir, he's dead already."
Yeah.
And so Bones just goes, "No, Jim."
Yeah.
So we get Spock's funeral. He gets blasted away. Kirk, listens to Scotty playing some amazing Grace on the bagpipes, which apparently was James Doohan's idea.
I love a bagpipe.
We see the birth of the Genesis planet now because the device has sucked up the Mutara Nebula. All the people that live in the Mutara Nebula, they don't get to enjoy it anymore. But
they're all dead.
They get to enjoy the Genesis planet. And Kirk softly quotes the last two lines of A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best, is a far, far better thing I do. Far, far better thing. And upon McCoy's inquiry, he goes, "Young, I feel young." And then this is one of the things that I love. We get to hear Leonard Nimoy give, finally, space, the final frontier.
He's a captain, so.
Yep. And they change the lines. Technically, for this movie, Spock is the captain of the Enterprise.
Is this the first time where it's not gendered language?
No, they say no man.
Oh, okay.
No, it's TNG is the first time. They do change a couple of lines in it. There's instead of new life, it's like it's something else. And this one still says no man.
Boo.
So it's not until TNG that changes, or no one has gone before.
Yeah.
All right, Ashley. Let's talk about who do we think is the best actor in this film?
Leonard Nimoy. Jason?
Why?
It's really hard to beat Leonard Nimoy in any Star Trek film because, one, I think he's the best actor among the cast, certainly among the standard cast. Also because Spock has a lot less range to play with, so the fact that he's even compelling at all is quite something. And this is Spock's movie. Emotionally, he shows out in this, like, the death over shines everything else in the movie. It's the thing that everybody knows. It's believable and it's emotional. So, like, it's absolutely Leonard Nimoy. Like, no question. Jason?
I completely disagree with you.
Cool. Who do you think is the best?
It's William Shatner.
Okay.
This is, it's so funny to me that, like, this is Kirk's movie.
I mean, it is presentationally, but the thing everybody knows about this movie is it's Spock, like, it's a Spock death.
We know that and we love that because we see it through the lens of Kirk. And maybe this is the movie that I would show anybody. Yes, there are some lines here and there that do not work.
That's just because of time.
But I think Shatner's performance in this movie is the reason we remember this movie. This is the reason why we think Captain Kirk is cool. This is, yes, it has good, of course, the con is, it's ridiculous, but it's memorable.
No, but it's great, though.
But, like, when he says human during Spock's line, it's just, like, it is mind-blowingly heartbreaking. This is the movie that I'm like, anybody that says William Shatner's a bad actor has not seen Wrath of Khan.
I would also make you could make the argument if you want that this is his last truly great performance as Kirk.
I
think there are moments of brilliance in the other ones.
There, I agree with you. I think he has some moments in three.
I think in all the rest of the movies he has moments.
I think he has moments in three. But you know what? I think you might be right that this might be his last, like, overall.
Yeah. Like, A-plus performance.
A-plus performance as Kirk. It might be this movie. Because, again, there are some moments in 3, but then also 3 has the, enough of you!
But there's also, like, great moments in, like, Generations.
There are.
Which is a silly movie.
There are some good movies. I actually do like, I don't like the way he dies, but I like his final line.
Yeah.
I think Captain Kirk's final line being, it was fun.
Yeah.
Is a fan. Apparently, that was Shatner's idea.
Yep. Very famous story.
Oh, and the oh my, him being like, oh my. No, I think it's William Shatner. I do think this movie does not work without William Shatner. And I think William Shatner carries most of this movie on his back. I actually think Leonard Nimoy kind of just gets to sit back and relax until his death scene.
It's the best scene in the movie.
It is.
Look, that's also Spock's my favorite. I have a huge bias towards Spock, I would definitely admit.
But I mean, even when we rewatched this last night, like, I was sitting here being like, man, anybody that thinks William Shatner was never a good actor is a fool.
He is fantastic
in this movie.
He's fantastic in a lot of things.
Yes, he is. He's amazing in Boston Legal.
Jason loves Boston Legal.
We talk about Boston Legal all the time. Anyways, if you listen to any of our Patreon pods, you know we're big fans of Boston Legal. Anyways, it's on Hulu apparently. Actually, what's the legacy of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan? Does this movie hold up? What do you think? Like, first, does this movie hold up? And what is the legacy of this film 40 years later?
Yes, 20 out of 10, it absolutely holds up. Mm-hmm. Its legacy is being one of the best, if not the best, Star Trek movie. I think maybe depended on your taste and the types of stories that you like.
Well, when we admitted at the very beginning, objectively, I don't know if there's any question, objectively, this is the best Star Trek movie.
I mean, even people who haven't seen this movie, they know, like, Khan! They know Khan with the bare chest.
And even the tings in the ears, the worms.
And they know Spock's death.
Yeah.
So, like, those are kind of the most important things in the movie. So
I would think a lot of people probably even know, even if you don't know where it comes from, I think if you hear Kobayashi Maru, you might be like, that's a Star Trek thing.
Yeah. But I think most people know the broad strokes of this movie. Uh-huh. And its impact in cultural history is, we're sure going to bring Khan back a lot.
Yeah.
Rather than chasing villains of the same caliber as Khan, we're just going to redo Khan a whole bunch. And we're also going to redo the death. And deaths in this style going forward. So there's a lot of good lessons that are lifted from this. Like, the exploration of filial bonds is something that I really love about Star Trek. But there's a lot of, like, really lazy tropes that come out of this movie as well, unfortunately.
I agree.
Is that it?
No, you're gonna. I was waiting for you to.
Not gonna say something else?
I was gonna wait for you to tee up the ball for me,
Jason.
Ashley. this is a two-hander podcast. I was gonna say that the legacy of this film is that this is the movie that popped, I think, Star Trek into mainstream.
I agree.
I think it's this movie.
I mean, it's certainly not TNP.
It's not. I bet a lot of people went and saw TNP that were not Star Trek fans, though.
I would agree,
Because Star, you know.
Like, and Serenity and Firefly.
Yeah, I think this is the movie. Like, this, you know, a lot of people talk about, like, oh, man, Star Trek's for nerds. And it is. And Star Trek's not cool. I think this is the movie that sort of made Star Trek cool for a while.
I agree.
Especially, like, I feel like most people in the mainstream went and saw the TOS movies in the 80s. Like, when a TOS movie came, you went and saw it. And it wasn't until the in TNG, The Next Generation came out, that people started like going away from that again. And then I think the Abrams movies brought people back to it. I think now people will go to a Star Trek movie in the mainstream. The legacy of this film is, one, this showed what the power of what you could do with this franchise and how so emotionally resonant you could make something. Because like, as much as this is a story about two guys shooting photon torpedoes at each other, this is really a movie about aging and accepting aging. That's really what this movie is. And that's why I think this movie lands on Shatner. It is about Shatner. It's about Captain Kirk accepting that he is not the gallivanting young man of the galaxy anymore. And he needs to accept, he accepts it through the death of Spock, that he will die one day. And he has to be okay with that.
Yeah.
And that is the brilliance of Star Trek, because Star Trek is pew, 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 but it always has that subtext underneath it.
Interesting.
And this is what that movie has. Now, the downside, this movie totally holds up, by the way. I will say that.
Oh, yeah.
The downside of this film is that this is the Star Trek film that convinced, even to this day, creatives and writers that Star Trek movies need to have supervillains. And I don't believe that anybody is a true villain in the Star Trek universe, because that's not the point of Star Trek. And people have been copying this movie in various ways for 40 years. And it's time to move on. That's the bad part of this legacy, is that like, we need to just, hey, Wrath of Khan is out there. You can watch it whenever you want, but we need to stop remaking it.
Yeah.
Because we're never going to beat it. You're never going to beat it.
Well, it's never going to be new. You're never going to be surprised by it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's the downside of this. But overall, I think this is astounding. I think it totally holds up. Ashley, what's the rating? I think I know what the rating of 1 to 5 Bregos. Brego, the intern cat, by the way, has snuck into the studio. He's in here, by the way. Yes. 1 to 5 Bregos, 5 being the best. What would you give Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan?
5 out of 5 Bregos. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
5 out of 5. There's no debate here. I can't even tell you a scene I would cut out of this movie.
I agree.
And that to me tells you that it's a perfect movie.
Yeah. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, really. So I can't tell you a time I haven't watched it and been completely sucked in.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree.
And I've seen it several times. I know exactly what's going to happen. I know Spock's going to die every time.
Are you sure?
I hope. Sometimes I hope he's going to get out of there.
Sometimes you hope he's going to die. Yep.
Sometimes I hope sometimes he gets what he deserves. I'm telling you, he deserves to get blasted by the mains and the radiation. And the radiation. Anyways,
yeah.
Ashley, let's move on. That's it for this podcast. Let's move on to the recommended reading, where if you go to geekhistorylesson.com/recommended reading, they're going to find some stuff related to Wrath of Khan, correct?
Yeah. Is there going to be anything on here besides the movie and the novelization?
I mean, just some cool, there's probably a making of Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
I don't have anything specifically.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to find some fun stuff to put on there for you.
Let's get to the honor roll. What's that, Ashley?
The honor roll is where if you go and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts and you give it 5 stars, we'll read whatever you want. You can literally say whatever you want. And if you are an international friend, please screenshot it and send it to geekhistorylesson@gmail.com and tell us where you're from, because we can't see international Apple Podcasts. Mm-hmm. So we have one brave soul entering the Teacher's Lounge today, and that is JNitch44, who says, Nerd Seminary. Love the show, love the format and the perspective they bring. They have a way of both sharing their opinions without dogmatic or arrogant. I think it's just to say without being dogmatic or arrogant, not to offer a note. They encourage their audiences to form their own headcanons. It's pure enjoyment without tribalism. Thank you, JNitch44, for an incredibly sweet review. Jason, what's going on in the teacher's lounge today?
Well, in the teacher's lounge, sorry for JNitch, it's tribalism 101.
taught by
Professor Nicholas Meyer. Khan Noonien Singh. Yes, that's a better joke. Khan Noonien Singh, he's in there. He's like, I'm here to teach you about the worms. I know that was a terrible Ricardo Montalban. I apologize. All right. Don't forget to download and subscribe and listen to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review. Please be like JNitch and join the honor roll. Ashley,
yes.
Where can they find Geek History Lesson on social media? And we have a blog as well. They can check out new blog posts every Thursday, correct?
We do. You can find us at facebook.com/geekhistorylesson and on Twitter at @GHLPodcast, on Instagram @geekhistorylesson, because they have more characters. And Our blog goes up every Thursday. We have supplemental material so that you can see what's going on. We just released a summer geek read list, and we released a blog about our first experience at Star Wars Celebration. So lots of fun stuff going on there. Please follow us on Instagram.
You can follow Ashley on Instagram and Twitter at Ashley V. Robinson. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Jawin. And if you want to hear more Star Trek talk, our episode of GHO Extra this week is Who is the Best Star Trek villain, because Khan is a very famous Star Trek villain. We're going to go through a list and we're going to decide who are the best Star Trek villains. And you hear that over at our Patreon at patreon.com/Jawin, J-A-W-I-I-N, where you get that and two extra pods a month, including Jason and Jeremy, John About Justice League. We review every single episode of Justice League. And Marvel Club is over there now, too.
So yeah, Marvel Club. About to swing into some Thor stuff.
Hashtag stick around, the final part of the podcast where we make sure you stuck through the plug. Ashley, we found out what my favorite scene in the film is. It's the scene where Spock gives Kirk his gift, his birthday gift, and William Shatner looks at the weird space janitor because he wasn't expecting that guy to be on set. What's your favorite scene in this film?
My favorite scene in the film, I think, is probably right after this, where Bones gives Kirk his glasses.
Oh, you like the Rednecks?
He's
like, why are we treating your birthday like a wait, Jim?
Yeah, I really like that scene. And that's also...
You like their 70s casual wear?
Yeah, man. Bones looks like he's going to a disco. I love it. Scene's also echoed in the Kelvinverse movies as well, with Carl Urban and Chris Pine on his birthday. And he's like, why are you so dour?
It's also echoed in Star Trek III. Because
that's true.
They all have the drinks. And I believe Kirk and McCoy wear the exact same clothes.
You might be right,
and
yeah.
You see everybody else's like casual 70s wear, and it's like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh,
woof.
Boy.
They were strong choices made.
They were. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Geek History Lesson. I am Jason, damn the photon torpedoes, Inman.
I am Ashley Victoria Robinson. And Professor Jason, would you please dismiss the class?
I will leave you listening to this podcast, buried alive.